Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode number 108 of the Opalogue podcast. This episode is brought to you in part by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial when you go to audibletrial.com/apologue. There's over 180,000 titles to choose from for your Android, iPhone, Kindle, Fire, or MP3 player. Anything that plays stuff. Anything that has the capability of being app-driven. Even a Samsung. Nah? There's tons of books. If you like books on tape, if you like someone reading to you, if you like regressing back to like a little boy when mom would read you a story and you'd sit there and listen. It's kind of like that when you're driving, you have responsibility and stress. So go to audibletrial.com/apologue to get a free audiobook and a 30-day free trial. Also, if you go to apologue.ca and click on the Amazon banners located on the right side of the website, you can support the show. You can locate your country, whether you're from Canada, United States, or the UK. Bookmark the link banners, and every time you shop on Amazon, use the links to shop and support the show. Costs you no extra money. If you like what's happening here and you want to pledge at a monthly amount, you can go to patreon.com/apologue. Patreon is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Patreon. And when you pledge on Patreon, you become a patron. I know it's confusing, but follow along. So what you do when you're a patron is you can pledge as little or as much as you want on a monthly basis. This will help me with my hosting fees, gas fees, equipment, anything. It really does help out. I drive all over the place. Like, I'm going down to the city in a couple of days. I'm going to do three episodes or three recordings. It costs money, folks. So please, help out. Be part of the four people that are already supporting the show. Go to patreon.com/apologue. This show is also brought to you by Insight Recorders. This show would not be recorded if it wasn't for Insight Recorders, because I've been recording music for well over 30 years. You can actually get your record mixed at Insight Recorders online. So go to Insight Recorders /contact. Get in contact and we'll make a record. Also, if you want to buy stuff from the shop, you can go to apologue.ca/shop and pre-order this new acoustic album. I swear to God, I'm mixing. It's almost done, folks. Okay? Just in time for Christmas. You can buy a t-shirt. They're running out by Foursquare Discography for $20. And you can actually, you know, help the show out that way. You're going to buy stuff, you know, having a shirt. That you know what? How about this? If you pre-order the acoustic album, I will give you the discography for free. How about that? Pre-order the album, get the discography for free. How about that? There's the thing. So what you have to do is you have to send me a message over Facebook or something that says potato. And if you say potato, I'll give you the deal. But you have to pre-order the album first. Okay? Okay. Deal. Like the show on iTunes. Don't forget to... don't like the show on iTunes. Subscribe on iTunes. Rate and review the show. Give it stars. Help the show out. Let it get up there in the rankings. It's been in the top 200 for weeks now, and I really like that. But what's really good is getting it above those BBC albums, like Desert Island episodes. I don't think they're really episodes. I think they're just playing stuff. I think they're old BBC shows that they're just, you know, it's not fair. Go to like the show on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/apologuepod. Follow me on Twitter at simonhead666. And that is it for the spots for now. Today on the show is John Picard, or also known as Mr. Zero, from a band called The Kings. The Kings were a band in the early 80s that were around since the late 70s. They got early starts, but they had what would be considered a mega hit in U.S. radio with this song called This Beat Goes On, Switch to Glide. There's two songs in one. It's like 5.5 minutes long. If you're not familiar with it, go on YouTube and search out "Switching the Glide" by the Kings. You'll see there's almost 2 million hits on a video they've posted just from old footage. There's a lot of history behind the band, and they were very cool people. When I met them, it's like meeting kind of like a little bit meeting. It's like meeting the Stones to me. Like, these are people, this is a band I listened to when I was 10 years old that kind of shaped me musically and sort of really did get me interested in music. And when I first heard it on like AM radio, I knew it was, you know, it was such a good feeling of a song. Go check it out, because I think you'll feel the same thing. And if you haven't heard of The Kings, then please go pick up their album. The Kings Are Here and More. And everybody, please, I'm so proud to let you hear about this episode, Mr. John Picard, or Mr. Zero, on the Apologue Podcast. John, we met just by you coming to our venue that I work at, and we struck a conversation, and I said, my God, this guy has seen, done, been everywhere, done it, and been one side of the mountain, the other side of the mountain, and, you know, there's a lot of history that comes with not just the Toronto music scene or the, I guess, the, it's Oakville, right?
Well, our band, as it turned out, the three of us went to the same high school.
Yeah.
Dave and our original drummer, Max, and me. But when I was in high school, Max and Dave were a few years ahead of me. Mm-hmm. So when I was going in, they were a year or so maybe of going out. But I knew, about bands in town and all that. And Max, his real name was Ed. He was the best drummer in town. And because, you'd see the local bands. And, I was younger. So I just knew for me that... And my brother was in a band. He was a drummer in a band, mm-hmm. like a high school type thing. And so I got to see some of the things that were around. And they left school and got into full time bands after high school. Dave did and Max did. And so as time went on, I got a chance to go see them play in their bar bands, because it was full-time bars back then. You could play six nights a week and make a living playing music, mm-hmm.
Not just yours, but everybody's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and so Dave was based out of Sarnia, down near Windsor in Detroit, and he played a lot in the States back then. And Max was based in Toronto and played a lot of the clubs and I think, and so I knew that, especially, and I saw all the other bands, but Dave was the most talented guy in Oakville. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was just head and shoulders. I mean, my brother and his cronies and all that, they were just fucking around. But but Dave had talent, and Max was a good drummer. And so he actually, Max, knew I played guitar, and came over to our basement to jam with me, and he played my brother's drums. And then I guess he liked something about it, and so he asked me to get into the band that he was in at the time. So that was my first band. Mm-hmm. And then it was that was sort of in high school. And then then after that, they all left and went full time and all that. And I saw their bands, like I said, but I wanted to be a songwriter. I always thought that, if I had anything to contribute, it would be as a, songwriting and being an original, outfit. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know if those two guys wrote songs, because the bands that they were in didn't do any original stuff when I saw them. It was, and a lot of the bands you'd see back then, they would play the hits of the day or Jethro Tull or whatever it might be, from Cat Stevens to the Grateful Dead or
yeah.
Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo, I don't know, whatever, all this type of stuff people played back then. And, I remember seeing bands in Toronto. I'd go to see bands, and they'd say, they'd play, okay, good. It was good song, good song, good song. Then there was sort of a shitty song, and at the end of that one, they'd say, and that was an original tune, and you could always tell that because it stuck out really like a sore thumb. And so I knew that I wanted to write songs, and. But I knew I needed somebody to write with. So I was looking for I always loved Elton John and that, and the sound of having a keyboard player in the band. And so I went and lived in England for a while, and, answered ads in the Melody Maker and that kind of thing. And
when was it?
When was this?
In the '70s, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Early.
Mid. Somewhere in there. I don't know. It's just amazing how you remember when it happens, but you forget when you. And then I moved to Vancouver. And then out there, somebody said that they knew this guy that played piano and sang. And that turned out to be Sonny. His real name's Nick in our band. And so we got together and we tried writing songs like, you know about music. So it's the major ways you write songs, or if somebody writes the words and music together, a lot of the time the music comes first and you write lyric, you get an idea with the lyric and you write the rest of it later. Or, I mean, I've studied all this stuff from, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein or Rodgers and Hart. Two big examples of the different ways that you could do it would be that, I think, Larry Hart wrote the words first for Richard Rodgers when they wrote together. And then later when he wrote with Oscar Hammerstein, I'm pretty sure Richard Rodgers wrote the music first and then Hammerstein wrote the words to the melody, which is the way that I prefer to do stuff. I generally wrote the lyrics in our songs and Dave writes all the music. And so, but the way we started was with Sonny, and he liked doing it with the Bernie Taupin way, where Bernie Taupin would give Elton John the lyric first. And then 20 minutes later, Elton John would have a song, you know. But when I was growing up, the ideas that I had, since I was a kid, I could hear different lyrics to songs. When I heard them on the radio or on TV or at cartoons or whatever it might be. And so I didn't know if it was anything, but I knew that other people couldn't do it, or I knew I could do it. And so I didn't know if, anyway, so I tried doing that, putting out the lyric first. And then, you know, we did some songs that were pretty good. We did some demos and all that. And that's when we decided that it'd be good if we had a real singer and a real band, because we're just the two of us doing it and out in the West Coast. And he lived in Victoria and I lived in Vancouver. And we'd get together at his parents' place on the island where he's still living with his folks. And I was living with my girlfriend in an apartment in Kitsilano in Vancouver. And so
that's a big commitment to get on the ferry to go to the island, because I know that's
funny, because we played out there this summer, and I hadn't been back. It's been a long time since we were back, and we were playing in Nanaimo, and so we took the ferry. You can take it up to Nanaimo, but it just goes straight up the Strait of Georgia, or we went over to Victoria and drove up the island because it's much more scenic. The ferry ride to Victoria is much nicer than the one to Nanaimo. It's pretty boring. Mm-hmm. But when you go to Victoria, you go through all the Channel Islands and the Salt Spring and all that stuff, and it's just a beautiful ride. And so it brought back a lot of memories, I'll tell you. The beautiful summer days and the blue sky. And I was texting Sonny, he was back in Toronto, and saying, man, this is bringing back a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And so anyway, yeah, we did that. And then, so we came back. And so I came back and approached Dave, who was like this, like I was the nerdy idiot in high school. And like, he was like the cool guy. And so now it's after that. And he's like full-time player and, you know, got a reputation. And I was like this nerd. And I found him, you know, approached him and said, you know, we have this tape. We have some songs. We want to write songs. We need a singer. And we need a drummer. So I'm going to find Ed and talk to him. So anyway, I think he thought I was out of my mind. And then for some reason, he listened to the stuff and thought, well, maybe these guys aren't. And then, you know, it was like he had some ideas along that. Like, this isn't a time when, you know, we didn't know each other. I knew of him. Like I said, I'd seen him around, and he was, to me, just the most talented guy I ever saw in town here. There's just no question. And I saw everybody in all the bands back in the day here. And so, that was my impression. And so that he said that he would, so we got some money together. We flew out to Vancouver and did another demo out there. And it was great, and then, I thought it would be me and Sonny working on tunes and all that. And I had no inkling that Dave was this genius songwriter that he is. Right. And so that was the thing that really, that's where we really lucked out, because I think it would have fizzled after a while if it was been left up to me and Sonny, because.
Was it a personality thing?
No, it's just, I think that the quality of music, because I for me, it was hard to write songs in that format of coming up with the idea first. Whereas Dave writes a melody, he could give him any piece of music, he can write a genius melody to it. Like I'm sure McCartney does the same thing. You give him any chord pattern, he'll write a fantastic melody.
Yeah.
And so, that's what Dave can do. And then I can generally make a song out of it, and write something to it.
So there's a nice gel in a chemistry that was just naturally formed, but based on your inkling saying, well, this person is a good performer, but you had no idea that he was such a great songwriter.
There's no, it was a miracle is what it was. And it was just the greatest, thing that could happen.
What era was this? Around mid-70s?
Yes, I guess. I mean,
because your first record came out in 77, right?
No, it came out in 1980.
80. Oh, okay. Well, you were a band in 1977 then.
We were still finding our way, I think.
The Kings, the first one with Switch and Glide, that's your first album. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's the.
So there's no demos. There's nothing out there beforehand that sort of.
Well, we have a CD. We have two. One's called the Anthology, which has got previous stuff from. We wanted to be a prog band. We wanted to be Genesis or Yes or something, and so that's where we kind of started. We started writing poppy shit, and then we started going into this other thing, and. Because you're young and you have all these ideas, and it's like, okay, let's go for it.
At the time, anything that had sort of musical weight to it in that era was like Yes, Genesis, Frank Zappa, all that stuff was stuff that was like, well, that's what the musicians play.
Well, I saw those bands, I saw Yes and Genesis and Frank Zappa, and
never saw Frank Zappa, but I did end up seeing. The newer version of Yes as a, the 90210.
Yeah.
Version.
I mean, it's great stoner music. Let's face it. And so, and I love hit songs. I mean, that's what it all came back down to was that, I love the Eagles. I love the Beatles, the Bee Gees. I love hit songs, and there used to be a variety of, of gatekeepers that would let certain songs on the radio that you'd never hear now, and because everything's just so many, there's so much dilution and of music now that, because everybody can make a record doesn't mean everybody should make a record.
that's been said a lot. And also the focus was the radio was something that if you're on the radio, you're going to sell records. Radio today isn't really that important. It's there, but it's almost like just keeping it there because it's been for so many years and the world owes it something, because we could switch all the radios off tomorrow and just go on the internet and have internet radio stations. There still obviously is a reason for radio because of ads and whatnot, but there's also a smaller focus. I think we talked a little bit about this when we first met, like, the focus of music in the mid to late 70s is, you can't compare it to today at all, because there was maybe three types. You know what I mean? Like, if you really narrow it down, popular music was played on AM radio, you know, and we had Elvis Costello, we had Squeeze and Split Ends and all this great power pop stuff that wasn't really even, I don't know.
But I remember hearing Chuck Berry on AM radio, you know, on Chum AM. And I remember hearing Whole Lotta Love by Led Zeppelin on AM radio, and Mississippi Queen, and they would have stuff like that on the radio, and you know, Louis Armstrong was on the radio. Hello Dolly was a hit, you know. I mean, so is that better? Or I think it's pretty good, you know, because you got exposed to this variety, I guess. And anyway, you know, I always loved hit songs because, and so we started writing all this froggy type stuff, and then it turned out to be we couldn't get any gigs. And anyway, what I was going to say was that we have a CD called the Lost Tapes of a 70s Bar Band, which is, we recorded at this club and over a Friday and Saturday night. And when we started doing cover songs, because we couldn't get any gigs being an original band like all the other bands. So the most we ever did was about 50-50. And that tape kind of covers our early days where we did, and it's really great. It's really the promise is there because Dave is singing his ass off. Sonny is still singing lead. And he does a great job in some of the songs. You know, we did, Squeeze Box by The Who, which, you know, I hate that song. And we did some Super Tramp and stuff like that, you know. Mm-hmm. And then we won this homegrown contest. The first one they ever had in Toronto was in, I think, 77. And it was on Chum FM at the and so there was 600 entries or something like that, and you send in your demo and they listen to it, and we won it. And of course, back, you know, as time went on, the I talk about it in our DVD, you know, the anatomy of a one-hit wonder, you know, that, you know, into the 80s and 90s, when they had the homegrown contests, you'd win $50,000 worth of gear and a recording contract, you know, and all sorts of stuff, you know. And we got a free lunch. And that was it.
With a record executive?
Yeah, like at some, you know, the ports or somewhere. You know, it was just so Bush League. But we did manage to get some other people interested in helping us out. And one of them was a DJ from Chum FM named Larry Wilson and his partner. Mm-hmm. And they kind of just steered us a little bit. And that's when we started getting more gigs, and we started doing more cover tunes in the power pop vein. Like, we did Cheap Trick and The Cars and Elvis Costello and all that kind of stuff in our live thing. And so we became a very polished bar band, and we used to play, you know, six nights a week all over the place. And, you know, the one place on Yonge Street we used to play, we played six sets a night, and then we had a three set matinee on Saturday, you know, and then six sets a night on Saturday. And so, you know, you really get good at, and that whole thing now, I think, is gone, the woodshedding like that. You know, the Beatles did it in Hamburg, and, you know, and we did it too. And so I think that was, I mean, Dave and Max were already seasoned professionals doing that for years because they were in those kinds of bands that did that.
Yeah.
But Sonny and I were still green, and that was our education, and so it was a very valuable thing for us. and we became, you know, good. And so I think that, I mean, that CD, The Lost Tapes of a 70s Bar Band, is really great. And that progressed into our other live CD, which is the Party Live in 85, which mm-hmm. is the original band, the from the era of Switching to Glide. The first album's on there, and our second album, a lot of it's on there too. And they're both great. And so the other neat thing that I've been working on lately, and here's a shameless plug, I guess, is that I'm putting out a DVD really soon, which is the third part of that sequence, I guess, which is it's a DVD that's is us live in a bar from probably 92 or somewhere in there. And mm-hmm. it's called No Covers, and it's it was shot with just one camera, and it's the kind of thing that I'm so happy that we have it, and the same with both those other tapes too, because I think it shows that we're good, you know, like, and when you look at it now, because it's like, you know, 23 years ago or whatever it is, you know, and you look at how young we are, and it's like, oh fuck, mm-hmm. you know. But it was a bar gig, and we brought in this monster PA, huge lights, smoke machine, you know, it's just the kind of production you used to have in bars. You know, bands would bring in all this stuff, and while the picture quality and the sound is not as like it would be today, I think that, you know, any of this kind of stuff is content driven. Content is king. And this thing, I worked hard to try to get the picture quality of it as good as I could with different dubs. It's shot on a VHS cassette, and it was Dave's camera that he got, and he could fit the VHS cassette fit right in the camera. It wasn't any kind of dubbing down, so it was or a separate little thing you carried around. It was the cassette fit right in the camera, and so the quality was pretty good. And this is three sets, and it's all original music, and there's songs that nobody's ever heard, and it's really great. It's just, I'm so happy that we have it, and I think it'll be a real wake-up call, you know, for our fans that would just, you know, they will love it. I know they will.
Well, I know that. Well,
I know that.
I can hear my own voice. Okay, now it stopped. I know that there's several generations of people who, like me, I'm 46. I heard Switching the Glide when I was 10 years old.
Yeah.
There's people who are 10 years younger than me that have heard it at a different time. And when you mentioned something about one hit wonder and things like that, I mean, it's really, I mean, how do you embrace that? Because that's kind of what people say, you know, but I call it a two hit wonder because there's two songs in one, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. But, well, it's the old line. We can do a medley of our hit.
But what I love about, because it's staying power and it's speaking still to this day of good times. And to me, I heard the record, you gave me the CD, and it's still, the drums sound great. It's produced awesome. Because I listen to, like, if you listen to old, even Elvis Costello, it sounds like Elvis Costello in that era, where if I hear this, it sounds like I could have recorded that last week. So it's a statement.
I think Bob did a good job on it. And, it's funny because we found this other tape that I'm resurrecting right now, that we've been working on, that we did in probably 85 or something like that. And, I was always sort of more of a purist. I just wanted to stick with, you know, but there was, you know, people that were saying, well, we gotta be hip and we gotta have modern sounds and all that. And I'm going, about that, but you know, I don't know if you remember the era when there was these
big snares,
synth. Well, before that, they had these synth drums, you know.
Oh, yeah, the Lynn drums or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, well, there was also the Simmons drum. They're hard pads that you hit.
Yeah.
And they go, boo, boo, and all this. And I found this tape that we did, and I had it transferred to the digital realm, and I found the little memory stick, you know, the other day, and you know, the memory stick.
Yeah.
And I listened to it, and you know, it was a multi-track. I think it was 8-track Tascam half inch or something like that. It was analog, so the sounds are pretty good, but the drums just suck on it really bad. I mean, Mike was a good drummer, you know, that played it, but the sounds are just really, really horrible. So so we redid them about 2 weeks ago, three weeks ago this weekend. And, you know, we've been editing the drums because we all went into Pro Tools. And just, you know, from the get-go, the song is just coming to life. And it's actually, you know, it's another thing that, you know, a project that we've been working on. And it's funny because it's another segue. And so I remember when Dave and I were working on it, we thought, this is it, man. This is the follow-up. This is what you and, you know, I don't think anybody ever heard it because we didn't, it just never realized its potential. And so what we've been doing is we heard it, Dave and I have been listening to it and putting, you know, it needs to be chopped up because it's, you know, Switching to Glide is about 5.5 minutes, give or take. This one was 6.5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so it had to get the scissors, you know, and, so that's what we were doing, the editing, and then editing the drums, you know, because Pro Tools, you can just move everything you want. You take a fill and cut it in half and, you know, make a new beat if you want. So that's what I've been doing with that. And I think that is another thing. The two projects that we've been working on lately have been those, this resurrecting this tune and, you know, with our current drummer, Toddy, playing on it. And then, this DVD of us live from this thing. And I just took it in to get manufactured the other day. So it'll be ready next week, this week coming.
Oh, so it's coming out pretty soon.
Yeah, I got to figure out what to do with it.
Right.
You know, but I'm going to have it. You know,
well,
and who's going to, you know, but see, the thing is, you can put something like this out, you know, but people are inundated with stuff, right? And anybody who are a viewer or whatever, I don't care what kind of Mickey Mouse magazine you write for, or paper or whatever, you get 100 CDs a week or DVDs. Mm-hmm. And this is a commitment because it's 3 sets in a bar, you know, and the best way to listen to it is with a few beers and some friends and, you know, just like you're there. I think, yeah, you know, that's the way to look at it. And definitely, I don't think anybody has that kind of time commitment to, unless they're, you know, fans already, you know?
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm honestly, it's one of those, well, I mean, it's almost like I want to keep it a secret because it's one of those, it feels like you guys feel like you're my band. You're my band from then. and there's a few bands in my life where it's like, I don't want to share this with anybody. I want this to be mine. It's mine. So trying to share that, it's, you know, definitely when you guys are playing our venue, I'm sharing the crap out of it because I think, well, that's important. People need to see this. But I know, does it feel funny for someone? This is the first question, actually. Does it feel funny when someone says, you were the soundtrack of my life when I was 10 years old? Does that make you feel like weird or odd or...
No, I think, you know, I think that people have said such nice things about Switching to Glide for so long now that, and, you know, I guess the video on YouTube will pass 1.7 million plays this week. Mm-hmm. You know, we just passed 4,000 comments on it this week. And people say the nicest things, you know, it's just, and they've written letters, you know, that nobody ever sees. I share some of them, but I mean, it's like you never get used to it, mm-hmm. but it just blows your mind and you can't really absorb it or, you know, let it get to you because it's almost too much, you know, especially because, I mean, you know, you can imagine what John Bon Jovi, I just saw him interviewed yesterday with Charlie Rose, you know, mm-hmm. what's he get every day of his life, you know, except he got the money as well. And we never did. Yeah. So that's the,
well, that's another thing is that in the 80s, the record industry was a little tumultuous and not very fair. And even today, it's kind of that way, only it's iTunes is keeping all the money and Spotify and all these streaming services are keeping the money. But the good thing about it is that a band today can put a DVD out because they have the means to do that because there's technology on their side where it's now in the home. Also the catch 22 is that there's a lot of that. So how are you going to rise to the top, you know?
Or, I don't know. I mean, that's the thing. You got to get somebody to pay attention to it that has some the ability to open some kind of gate, you know?
And that is the older school of record industry. Like I've spoken to, there's a guy who's been on my show. His name's Cam Carpenter. He worked for MCA Records all throughout the 80s. MCA, he worked for BMG. He signed Steve Earle, or he worked with Steve Earle when Steve Earle first came to Canada. He says, and I kind of like the first, you know, before this conversation I had with him, I would say, good is good is good. Good will always be noticed and all that stuff. And what he would tell me is, no, you need actually a little committee of people working behind you to, like you say, open the doors, develop you, prepare you for what possibly could happen, like success or failure, but you need to be prepared. And there's people on YouTube that have, like you say, 2 million, there's 2 million plays, and all they do is tell funny jokes on the internet and they're huge and famous, but they don't know how to handle it.
Well, our little thing with, you know, it's not even 2 million views, but it's a drop in the bucket, but I mean, we know that they're authentic views, you know, as opposed to some kind of robot thing or whatever.
Yeah.
And you know, people, you know, I, you know, you wonder, I think a lot of people have watched it 100 times, you know, and that's the thing. They don't buy the CD. They go watch the video on YouTube 100 times, you know, and what you were saying earlier about, you know, what's it, the soundtrack and all that. I just think that for us, it's, you know, if we were good enough to come up with something as good as Switching to Glide, don't you think we might have a couple other good tunes, you know? Like,
see, like that bit you on the ass. You had such a great song out the gate that people, you had this thing attached to you. People were like, you can't do any better than that. That's the best you can.
Well, that's what people have said.
I'm jokingly saying this. You know what I'm saying, right?
But it's true, though. I mean, people... I mean, we've had, you know, some of the comments we get is like, this is the greatest rock song ever, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's...
because you go, it's 5.5 minutes long, you know? It's a single at that length. That's a hard thing to do. People like Michael Jackson could do stuff like that.
Well, it was a real coup or some kind of fluke more, I guess, that... because the single was Switching to Glide. That was the initial single. And that's what we played when we played on American Bandstand with Dick Clark. We did Switching to Glide, and then he talks to the band for a minute, and then you do the second segment, and that was Don't Let Me Know, which was going to be our second single, and which is probably the oldest King song that we play, and it's Don't Let Me Know. Mm-hmm. But it didn't gain any traction at radio when it was released on Elektra as a single, Switching to Glide. Mm-hmm. You know, a little bit. And then we were pressuring them and our manager and, you know, put out the segue. And they finally did. There was a few key people at the promotion department at Elektra. And you know, this is what you're saying is, if you don't have that team behind you, you know, this is their job, is to promote records, and you know, your manager's job is to make you money and get you gigs, you know what I mean? Like you need that or else you will not succeed, because the artist is not a businessman, the artist is not a manager, you have to wear all those hats, I think, nowadays. But it's really you know, counterproductive. If you have somebody look at, you know, there's lots of jobs in the business, you know, without being on stage, you know? And so, you know, you go to any gig and there's guys that are setting up, you know, the gear, and there's guys that are running the sound and the lights and the stage hands and the ushers and all the rest of it, like at your place, you know, maybe you do all of it, but, you know, it's, you know, but you know what I'm talking about. So, I mean, it's all those things are important to put on a show. And it's the same with putting out a record, you know, and you need the radio stations, you need the program director, you need, you know, the advertisers buying the time to make the radio station work, you know. But, and I did an interview, it's on our website, our YouTube channel, The Kings Are Here, where a couple summers ago, we went down and played in Chicago. We had a gig in Wisconsin opening for Ted Nugent, of all people. And that was sort of the anchor date that we get that got us, you know, down. And we played another couple of shows while we were there. And then we had a chance to meet with Bob Stroud, who was one of the big DJs in the 80s in Chicago on WMET and then The Loop. And his colleague Bird from, they're both on WDRV now in Chicago. And Bob was one of the first guys that championed us in Chicago. I mean, Chicago is a huge town for us. We got on WLS as well. You know, just these huge radio stations, and they played the shit out of Switching the Glide and the Segway. And so I asked him, and you can see the interview. He's a really cool guy. We're just having a nice little, you know, soft drinks outside on a patio in downtown Chicago, summer day, beautiful and everything. And I said, you know, so the first time you heard Switching the Glide, you know, what did you, you know, did you think it was a hit? And he said, listen, man, I got hit ears. The first time I heard that song, I knew it was a smash, you know, just from the get-go. And, you know, he said that his program director had the album. He said, we're going to maybe add this. You got to put it on a cart. I don't know if you remember what those are. Yeah. It's like an 8-track.
Yeah.
You know, you transfer the vinyl to an easy play thing the DJ can just slide into the machine, instead of queuing it up on the vinyl. And so he said the first time, you know, it just freaked him out. And it was so, what a great guy, you know, and to hear a real radio guy talk about it like that. And his colleague Bird, who was actually a Q107, then worked all over the States. Now he's a big guy in Chicago. You know, it's a real, to hear it from real guys like that, you know, and so, yeah, it means a lot. And I mean, you know, more than I think people will ever know how much it means to us. You know, obviously, you know, we never made any real money from it, but at least we know that we, you know, they really only let us up to bat once, you know, since it's Major League Baseball week and the Chicago Cubs. But, you know, we got signed to a major. That's like getting it signed to a Major League Baseball team.
And then, the lottery a little bit.
Well, that, you know, but I mean, you have to be good to get there, right? And yeah. I think that that's the point that we make in our DVD is that, you know, we rehearsed and wrote songs and practiced and did gigs for 2 or 3 years. And we, you know, we played, you know, lots and lots and played shitty places and played, you know, and worked and rehearsed and played every night. Yep. And so when opportunity came knocking, we were ready to take advantage of it. And so when Bob Ezrin heard our stuff and said, you know, there might be something here, we were ready to do it. And I think that is the key, is being prepared.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you were saying too about manager artists, like how they don't work together very well. I can firsthand tell you that, no, it's really hard to demand something from a record label when you're the artist.
Yeah, well, you can't. That's not your job.
Not your job, but people do that, and they do it. It becomes one of these now, everybody's so complacent, like, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but I, you know, and I want you to keep working with me because I'm the artist. Now, you need that one guy that's smoking a big fat cigar, like throwing his phone on the ground, like, I'm going to hang up on you now. You need those guys.
That's Bruce Allen.
Right? That's what I was mentioning. You need these people, and
our manager was like that. Randy Phillips. He went on to become one of the biggest guys in the entertainment business.
And you'd never cross that person because that person has weight and power. And when you're signed to that person with weight and power, that pushes you a long way.
But or just you know, chutzpah, you know, that they need that confidence and that,
yeah,
you know, the gift that they will cut somebody else's throat, but not their band's throat, you know?
Yeah, I always thought it was like really sort of, when I worked for some bands, some of the managers would just walk in front of a train, you know, to save these bands, or would fight to the death. Like, if you ever said anything disparaging about the band, you're the enemy.
Yeah.
So, and, yeah, it's tough, right? Because it's blinders. You have blinders, and you're like, this is my person. As a manager, I don't know if I have that. Maybe I was just the manager. Maybe I could, you know, will the strength to. But when I was a manager of my own band, I couldn't get anything because I didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. And then when I started getting pissed off, then I'm the crazy person that is making outrageous demands, you know, like, why doesn't the CD end up at the club? So when we show up on the other side of the ocean, that maybe the CDs could be at the venue. That's not too much to ask, you know? I don't know.
Listen, the team is very, very crucial to any band that ever had any success. And, I remember we had a Canadian manager, God bless him, Gary. And, you know, he did what he could, I think. But this one day, Dave and I were living in this apartment in Mount Pleasant and St. Clair area in a house. And, you know, one day there was a knock at the door and it was this guy. And he said, you know, I came from California. I've tracked you guys down, and I want to be your manager. He said, I can make you money. And he says, do you know what you're doing in the States right now? You know? And we're going, well, what do you mean? You know? We just played in Ottawa, you know? And he said, you're climbing the Billboard chart. You know, you got a bullet. Your song is happening. And it's taking off at radio. Let me help you, you know? And so, and it turned out to be Randy Phillips, and this guy who later went on to run AEG, the biggest concert company outside of Live Nation. He was the head guy there for many, many years. He managed Prince. He managed Rod Stewart. He managed, you know, all sorts of big people. He's the guy that probably... He's the guy that basically got Michael Jackson to commit to all those shows, the 50 shows at the O2 in England that killed him. Mm-hmm. If you look at the documentary, This Is It, I think is the name of the documentary about Michael Jackson, that last rehearsals that he was doing for that. Randy's the producer of that. And he was our manager. And he was one of those guys that you're talking about that just was a, you know, don't take no for an answer and just you're out there to get the job done. And he really did. He really pushed the record company once he was on board to take this, to switch the segue to bigger heights. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of guy you need. And that's another reason why we haven't, I think, you know, perhaps followed up is because we haven't had a guy like that.
Yeah, but it's tough because there's that line between do-it-yourself and getting a team behind you. But there's gray area in between, right?
Well, yeah, but I think that, listen, there's all sorts of people that approach, you know, different people and maybe that. But there's no point in moving sideways. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, like, you know, and here in Canada, you know, you get a guy like Bruce Allen, you're moving up. Mm-hmm. But there's lots of guys that are just going to move you sideways, you know, and it won't be up.
Yeah. The other one is label/manager. That's a awful conflict of interest that I've ever,
I think that these days, I knew a guy that had people with small labels and, you know, they try to go it alone or something. And they say, well, look at, you know, so-and-so band. You know, I don't know, Mumford and Sons or some goddamn thing made it. They're on an indie label. And I said, you know, it's easy enough. You go and you just dig a little bit. And every time it's an indie label, there's a slash major there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you cannot do it. The majors own the radio stations. They own the distribution network, you know, such as it is, physical product. But they own every gateway into the digital world, too. And, you know, they control everything. And so without that clout, you know, you've got to make a deal with a major to get anywhere. And I think you've got to have the right manager to facilitate that. And that's just the way it is. You could have a nice little, you know, a little indie company. And I'm sure there's some in Toronto, but if you looked at the ones that have done anything, I'm sure they're all affiliated with a major label somewhere there.
Well, a lot of the reason, like I worked for a band that were on a major through a subsidiary. Yeah. And the only reason they did it is for cred, is to show like, hey, we're do it yourself. We're punk rock, you know, we're this. And we still had Island Records behind us. You know, we were still parking in front of the Island Records building with our van and trailer, but that was Island Records. You know, that was a big label. It still is. It was Universal now, but you know, to have that sort of team behind you, there's a lot of people out there who go, you know, I don't know, like the industry of music and things. Like myself personally, I don't know. I've never been there. I've never had a number one single in America or in Canada.
Neither have I.
Well, it came pretty close.
No. We only got to 43, I think, in the Hot 100.
It's number one to me.
Yeah. No, it got certainly in a lot of major markets. It got top five. You know, a lot of major cities.
But my point is that because you got there to try and keep that momentum, it's a very tricky thing, and that's where growing pains. So if you can't, you know, deal with the growing pains sometimes, and your team and your foundation and everything might not be as strong, you might have the best song in the world, but it's not going to propel you into that next level. And as a musician, getting into that next level might not be a very good thing for you mentally. So therefore, the songs stop. So if the songs stop, you're not going to go any higher. You know what I mean?
I think that people, like, when you realize how hard you worked, you know, like I said, how much playing and writing and all that we did, to get that door to open a little bit and to get in there, and then you realize that's when it really starts. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't, there's no coasting. Mm-hmm. You got to really knuckle down. And, when you think of bands that you know, everybody's heroes, you know, that had these giant careers, the Eagles or Elton John or anybody like that, mm-hmm. how much music you have to play and write. And then it's just a lot to come up with. And you have to be really talented to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that our output is not that prolific, let's say. You know, over time, we've accumulated quite a lot of songs, I think. And I think we have, you know, on iTunes, 65 songs now or something. And I think there's still, you know, a fair number more. You know, I think we're up in the 80 to 100 range probably that we've worked on, which is a lot, you know.
Yeah.
To finish, you know, to begin a song and finish it, you know. That takes a lot of doing, and you know, not all of them are good, that's for sure. And but yet you're committed to finishing it, so I think you should follow it through. But you know, did we know that This Beat Goes On and Switch and Glide was going to be a hit? Or you know, it always was a good one. Mm-hmm.
You had to have that feeling somewhere, though. Like
I don't know. I mean, it was the one that other people, you know. I guess we thought it was good. Yeah. I mean, we thought it was just this dumb song that mm-hmm. was pretty good.
Did anybody ever tell you, hey, you need to break it into two? Or is it always, it was two songs. So, but anybody say, who came up with the idea to make it into one song?
Well, it was the length of it, right? Because, right. And Switch and Glide was on its sort of self-contained, if you will, but mm-hmm. It isn't really, because with the other thing, it's so much better. And so for us, it was once we had it, I think that Dave had this revelation that when he was working on it, that he could put the two of them together.
Like and there a was live a, show. Yeah.
Yeah, or just in general, because we had the two songs, and then there was a night in Toronto which of much revelry, I think, that I wasn't there for, but it's gone down. It's, you know, this, you know, he had this revelation of putting them together, and I got it.
Yeah.
You know, and it was in the beach, you know, down on Queen Street in the summer, and, you know, it was good.
Yeah. Oh, of course. To be able to, well, I mean, you can hear whether it's like almost like it was a live show. It is like a live show. You're segueing into the next song. And I guess this beat goes on. This is, it has a chorus. There's a chorus there, right? So, but it doesn't have a bridge. So maybe that's the reason why it got turned into the next song. I don't know. You know, yeah, I don't know.
It's creative is what it is. I think that it's got some parameters of song structure outside of the norm, you know, but we just wanted to make it hooky. And I think that when we had it, there's an original version you can hear of it, that the chords are different and this beat goes on. Switch the Glide is basically the same. Mm-hmm. It was pretty much verbatim, but this beat goes on. When we started working with Bob Ezra, and he said, there's something wrong with this song. And it was just the chord pattern and the lyrics were not right. Mm-hmm. And so Bob is the kind of guy that points that out to you. He says, okay, it's not working. Go fix it. You're the songwriter. Yeah. Go make it better.
Here's what makes me not like it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's like, and I do it when I hear songs. I'm not in that capacity as being hired to do it. But what he would do is he'd listen to a song cold and go, okay. And then when he got to something he doesn't like, he'd go, stop. That's where it goes off the rails. So this is the part we have to work on. And so in that particular case, he said, this is not right. Something is wrong. And so Dave was playing into a C chord, we changed it to the D to the A instead of a C to a G, and then switched it around. And so that made it musically better. And then the lyrics had to change because they were the most obscure, esoteric bunch of bullshit ever. And so, you know, and that was I just try to make it hooky and dumb and good.
Yeah.
You know, and it always had Hey Judy and Trudy and all that, but then it got off on this tangent of you know, this other stuff, which Dave always reminds me of. You know, like one line was, lots of dusty mentals can be blown at any time. You know, it's like, what the hell is that?
Stream of consciousness, man.
It was almost like that, you know. Oh, yeah. And I thought I knew what I was talking about, but I hadn't got a clue. And then, so if you take it, and there was another song we did that with as well, rewriting it, taking it from the esoteric to about people, you know.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Because you're communicating with people who don't know you. And, and, you know, if they know you from the clubs, they're going to, oh, that's them. That's what they do. But if you're talking to a mass audience of people, I think the magic's created when people listen to it and can tune in and make their own story. Like, you don't need to put it on the nose. You know, I agree sometimes of going off in tangents lyrically because it makes me think, well, what are they thinking? What are they talking about? I mean, like, what's going on? Like, you look at, I don't know, Pink Floyd, for an instance, you know, it's dark, crazy stuff, but for some reason, I feel comfortable listening to that. Is that weird? And speaking of Pink Floyd, was it pre-Wall or post-Wall?
The first one after the Wall.
First one after the Wall. Wow. He must have had stories, because there's some books written about the making of that album.
Well, he told us some stuff about it, I guess. And other people, he worked with Kiss and Peter Gabriel, yeah. Alice Cooper, of course. Biggest hits.
Yeah, well, your record sounds, like I said, it was recorded yesterday and, on good equipment. Where did you record that, by the way, that album?
It was done at Nimbus, where he did Alice Cooper.
Okay.
Nimbus 9 in Yorkville. It was just on Hazleton, across from Hazleton Lanes.
Because Alice Cooper spent a bunch of time in Toronto, didn't he?
Well, he had a Toronto band after Ezrin fired his original band. The guys that got into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with Alice, and then the guys that made him all that money, Prakash from Toronto and Whitey, mm-hmm. The drummer at Prakash, the bass player, they're good friends of ours. Mm-hmm. And he's the guy that, those are the guys that Bob hired to be Alice's band because they could really, really play and they weren't, mm-hmm. messed up. And then they went on to play with Lou Reed and just a great rhythm section. They're still buddies of ours and I they were such heroes of mine. I sort of can't believe that we're friends, it's one of those things.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I know what you mean. To be able to, to be invited to the party, I think too, is enough knowing. And you know how it is with people are people. And you guys are just normal, nice guys. And that is powerful to me, to guys like me. And I think your fans is because you're people, you're like me, and I can attribute myself, I understand, or I know where you're coming from, because there's a lot of people I've spoken to who have won awards and sold lots of records and maybe got bit in the ass too, that I don't know if I really want to talk to these people, because they just seem to be angry or vindictive or spiteful. And I don't catch any of that from you guys.
We're friends. In those bands that travel in separate buses and they only get together on stage and, all that kind of, I love the Eagles, but I thought the way they treated Don Felder was pretty lousy.
Oh, I saw the documentary.
You could just tell that Glenn Frey, it's like maybe that contributed to it. It ate him up inside. His hate for that guy, it's like,
yeah,
can't go around carrying that kind of hate and baggage.
Coming from a guy who wrote The Heat Is On.
Like,
come on.
His original stuff was not as good as Don Henley's original stuff. His solo stuff.
Of course. He was completed by the Eagles. Don Henley seemed to be sort of held back from the Eagles, but then seems to come back to the Eagles like a nice warm blanket.
I understand what they're saying about Don Felder, but they were the ones that gave him the partnership in the band. When he joined, they said, you're an equal member.
Yeah.
So later they want to renege on that, and it's like, well, why should I?
Yeah.
And the other thing is, they're all so rich. They are we have a little tiny hit song that didn't do much at all. And, we made some, we still make some money from it. And when you think of how much the Stones make or how much the Beatles make or the Eagles make, believe me, it's a staggering amount of money because it's in every country in the world mm-hmm. they get money from.
Yeah.
And airplay and radio. Sales and now streams and all the rest of it. It's just a staggering amount of money. And for them to just be, and there's another, Canadian artist that I talked to, about, I don't think I should be mentioning any names, but
what do you got to lose?
Yeah,
you never get played in the radio again. Wait a minute, I can't say that.
anyway, there was a guy, a famous like singer and his writing partner that had a falling out. And I was fortunate enough to email the guy that had the falling, not the singer, but the writing partner guy. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me about how petty that some of this stuff they got into was. And it blew his mind, like the lying and the subterfuge and the bullshit. And I'm just going, you guys are all multi-millionaires. Like, who gives a shit?
Yeah.
Of counting the number of words you have in a song.
It becomes an egotistical race to see who's more powerful. Like, yeah.
I don't know. I just couldn't, we don't really do that. We do to a certain extent, but fair is fair, right? I think that is the whole key to the partnership is that,
Yeah.
You do more if you the whole thing, well then that's yours, Yeah.
Yeah.
I know the Beatles, did all Lennon McCartney, even if it was a Paul song or a John song, Yeah. But I don't think you really, and I think a lot of bands get into a lot of trouble with that sort of all for one and one for all kind of attitude in the beginning, because it usually turns out to be one or two guys that's doing everything, right? And the other guys, does Larry Mullen Jr. really write all those songs with Bono and The Edge? I don't think so.
He just looks the same as he did 30 years ago. That's his job, is to look exactly the same. He's I don't know how they do it.
He's a handsome young Irishman.
And he's what, he's 62 or 70? I love the fact when you say that, because I have forever, when I've made a band or had a band, I always would, my utopian band is the band that all have little jobs and they all have stuff to do, because we all do. Like my job when I toured, we'd go to Europe, I'd drive, I would set up the tours, I would rent the gear, I would book the plane flights. The least the band could do was hang the t-shirts on the wall. That to me is a little thing, but it's all becomes with personality. And when you play in a band full of people who are like-minded, you're going to be able to, like you guys, have a long lasting relationship and be friends and put up with not just the good stuff, but also the bad stuff. Cause that, it all happens. It's all encompassing.
Well, I find that, I do a lot of stuff, and I really think it's just my pleasure and privilege. At the end of the night, I'll generally take down Dave's amp and wrap his cords and put away his guitar or whatever it might be, Mm-hmm. Like, he's the star of the show, It's like he's the singer. Why should he be doing that, Mm-hmm. Like, I don't mind doing it, He's sweating his balls off out there. Mm-hmm. He's back in the dressing room taking it easy, having a beer, I'm happy to do it, mm-hmm. And everything else, it's like, you can't, let the small stuff really get to you, it's just small.
You have a 35 plus year relationship that goes longer than, hey man, put your amp away. Cause I've thrown people's amps downstairs. That person decided to get in a cab and go party when I was the only one left to clean everything up and load the van. So I have a different approach. My approach is a little bit more, hey, let's all pitch in, maybe in 35 years, maybe that's going to be different.
I don't know.
Maybe not. That's my personality. I think everybody, I believe in a little bit of Russian, a little bit of Russia. In a band, we all need to do our part. If I write all the songs, do all the recording, deal with all the record label, do all the driving, rent the gear, drive the band around, and then deal with the hotels, hang the fucking t-shirt up.
Well, I don't know. You seem to like doing everything else.
I know, but maybe that's my own thing, is that maybe I've taken those jobs where someone, if I would have just let it sit for like maybe a day or so, someone else would go, oh, I'll do that. Maybe that's the control freak in me that just wants to.
I'm not good at merch either. I sometimes I even brought a few t-shirts to your gig and I just left them in the car.
I got a CD.
Yeah. And a hat. So
I still got, honestly, going back to that day, I felt really, it did bring me back to, music that music takes you to a spot, you know, it does. It takes me to a spot. And I can't not listen to like Pink Floyd Animals and go, oh, I can't wait for that solo to come up. I can't not do that. Nor can I wait when I hear the radio and I hear your song. I'm like, oh my God, I'm a 10-year-old kid driving this car now, you know? So that's the power of music for people people like us, I guess. Some people, I don't know, I've yet to meet those people like, you know, music, I could take it. I don't need it. I've yet to meet those people. There's a lot of music is so powerful for that.
It's super powerful. And, when people let you know, there's people that don't have a musical bone in their body, but they love music. They just love it. And they buy, they buy product and they listen to the radio and they phone in and they go to buy concert tickets. Mm-hmm. Those are the people we love, And when they go out of their way to get hold of us or to leave a comment or say something nice, I really try to respond to it as much as I can. And, people have said some amazing things, and that's just us, with this one little thing, let alone, like I said, Paul McCartney or Bon Jovi or somebody.
Sure. Yeah. I think, it's tough to say this, but, I've suffered for my art. We've all suffered for our art. There's a reason why we suffer. It's because we love what we do. And you can't, the money would be great. But the sort of the adoration of the people that listen to it. Like I get occasionally somebody will contact me, through my Hotmail account. That's, from 1999 saying, I loved your band. I still got a Hotmail. Yeah. So to me, the same thing, only it's a smaller thing, but at the same time, it's like, wow, well, you know what? I didn't make $1 million, but I have something to hang my hat on. And I believe that's your situation too, and
it is very much so. I think that, and I hope that for you it's not over yet, because I know for us it's not over yet.
No. So you have your DVD coming out. Any new music? I know you're working on a new record, but can you?
We're just trying to
music wise.
We have songs that never got treated right or recorded right, mm-hmm. and so I think the project would be to try to figure out. And we have live versions of stuff that are. Better than studio versions. I mean, that's the thing, because it's that's the thing. Making records is a different animal altogether than it's a real creative, different space. And
we're in a great time now with technology where we have a computer can get hooked up to the live board and you can take as a good or bad sounding board feed and use that. Not just to show people like, hey, we know how to do this, but sometimes you luck out and you go, this is really good. Like I've been in the same boat, you know, where it's sometimes you just put a 2-track recording together and go, I could put this out like this, this and it feels good. Yeah. And I think we've both been in that situation. Where we're sitting in a studio over and over and trying and working and trying to polish it and try to perfect it. And then you're putting it out. And then to me going, I've put this out, I put so much work into it. Why doesn't anybody love this? Why? You know what I mean? Like, so
I've seen guys work on a snare sound for 2 days.
Yeah. I've been in those sessions. Do you ever heard of this band called Arson?
No.
The drummer is David Quinton Steinberg, who used to play in Stiv Bader's, an old punk band. And he played, he's also Drake's manager and Rush's manager, like business manager. He played drums on this Arson Records, like a 77 kind of like punk rock band. And they're all, and he came in and played like to my studio and played 12 songs in 5 hours. And that was turned into the record.
Yeah.
It was, that's the way it's got to get done, man. I mean, yeah. I mean, I've just my whole life, if I own a studio, you can spend as much time as you want in it, but it feels better when it's done, you know, effectively and efficiently, and it feels live.
Yeah.
You know, and so I can understand why you want to release live stuff, because it feels good. It feels better, more energy. It's more obviously alive, but it doesn't seem hindered. It's simple.
But it's also not off the cuff, because we rehearse it 100 times too, right? So
yeah, but then you're feeding, there's people feeding you that energy that you're giving it back, you know, and it sounds hippy trippy, but it's true. Like, you know, when one thing I've noticed about myself is if I'm in front of a crowd of 50 people, I'm like, hi, everybody, here's some music. But if there's 1,000 people out there, it's going to be a whole completely different addressing. You know what I mean? It just, you get excited, so you play harder.
I get excited for 50 people too. I get a lot more nervous in front of 1,000 than I do for 50.
Yeah. Okay, so you're sort of introverted a little bit and you push it inside a little bit, or?
Well, I find for me, it's just the pressure of not fucking up multiplies, mm-hmm.
And our sound systems are so good these days. You hear everything, yeah. Everything.
Every note. But I think that we played good at your gig.
Yeah.
I think the band was a good gig for us.
It was great. Everybody had an awesome time. We did know, we played with, there were some other bands on the bill. We don't need to mention who, but you guys and Trixie were definitely the two fun to hang with bands who got it. Does that make sense? You just got it. There's nobody's trying to fool anybody. Nobody's trying to live in the past. Everybody's just living for the now, and that's what I got from both you guys. I really enjoyed that night, and
Oh, good.
Yeah, I'd bring you back next week if I could.
I think you got a venue there that could support, the occasional gig like that.
Oh yeah, yeah. Let's hope. If something changes within my career there, I can make that happen. And if you want to write some songs, you let me know. I love writing songs with people,
All right.
I love writing songs.
I usually just tell people, I'm already married, it's like for me, it's the ideas are so few and far between that, we have everything we're trying to, but we'll stay in touch for sure.
Yeah, man, for sure. I appreciate that, and we've gone on for 81 minutes, my friend.
Oh, dear.
That's been great. The funny thing is we're talking like people, so that's what happens in conversation. Sometimes it just gets, And I think I knew who you were talking about, the songwriter and the singer, where the two. I think I know you. When we switch off, I'll ask you, see if I got it right. Well, John, did anybody actually just call you Mr. Zero these days? Is that like, hey, Mr. Zero?
Yeah, like the band kind of stuff is still Zero, I guess. Yeah. It's a lot of people named John, so.
Yeah.
In the crowd.
Yeah.
I
bet you when that Star Trek came out, you were pissed, right? Because the people would start going, engage.
Well, actually, I worked in the movie business on movie sets for a long, as a day job kind of thing. And I was on set on, one of the Star Trek, they shot here, Final Conflict or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the...
Might have been Deep Space Nine, maybe? Deep Space Nine?
It was a Gene Roddenberry...
okay.
Nothing to do with the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
But this one day on set, Majel Roddenberry was on set, who was his wife. And she was nurse... what's her name? In the original Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Nurse, some like Chapel, maybe Nurse Chapel, might be.
Yeah,
in the original series, and she was Gene Roddenberry's wife. And so, you know, I went up to her one day and I said, you know, my name's John Picard. And, and I, you know, where did that name come from? And she said, oh, Gene made up that name. And he just loved it. He just thought it was a great name. And I thought, well, okay. You know, it was good because it made, you know, people pronounce it right, Picard.
And, what were they going with? Pikard? Pikard?
Pikard or whatever. Pikard. You know? And so that, you know, and so I just said, well, you know, now I know, you know.
Yeah.
She was nice about it.
Yeah, yeah.
As you'd expect.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
All right, Simon, yeah.
Yeah, man. Anytime you want to talk turkey or promote something, the door is always open. You guys, like I said, there's certain times in my life where things change for me, have changed. And there's definitely something there between this era of like listening to like Beatles to listening to my own music, which was you guys. And then later went into metal, like Iron Maiden. When Iron Maiden came out, I was like, oh, wow, my life changed then. So there's certain times in my life when that post-punk new wave stuff just, I still listen to it. I love it, you know. So thank you much for doing that.
Thank you. That's incredible. I mean, I liked, you know, I liked the Ramones. I thought they were good, you know.
See, I never really got into the Ramones, right? Yeah. Like, I'm not.
Well, if I would know all their songs, but I mean, as far as that ethos or whatever, like, the Sex Pistols were a boy band put together, like, NSYNC or something, right?
Yeah.
It was just a manufactured, you know, Malcolm McLaren just got these guys and made a thing.
There's a lot of things with the Ramones where it influenced a lot of other music. So no Ramones, maybe no Kings, maybe no.
Well, I don't know. They were just authentic at what they did.
Yeah.
You know, we were never going to be a punk band because we knew how to play our instruments. You know, that was like, we wanted to know that.
Yeah.
We'd be pretty good players. And, you know, the punk was a rebellion against prog and all that other stuff. Mm-hmm. You know. The boring studio long expertise of players, punk was a revolution. We don't have to play to be good musicians to be able to play rock and roll music really fast, which I agree, you know, and some of it's really great. You know, we wanted to, you know, construct, you know, creative type hit type songs.
You were of the post-punk nature. You know, that's sort of what people call new wave, unfortunately. Yeah. But post-punk is what I call it. Because new wave went into more, I don't know, the romantic stuff and the sort of the big crappy sounding snares and that stuff. That's, to me, was like new wave. Even Duran Duran was like a new wave band and then then turned into a pop band.
Well, we were always just a rock band. I think that's our legacy. We like to
rock.
Pocket.
You filled a nice pocket of the blend between, like, what I call, like, because to me it feels rebellious to sing some of your songs. I still feel that sort of falls into a little bit of like a punk rock ethic, you know. And then there's obviously songwriting, and there's playing, and production. Well,
our band is nothing without Dave's voice. I mean, that was the key to the whole thing. That was the thing that got me, to try to get him on board when we first started doing this was just. It's all about the singer and the song. I said it 100 times.
Yeah.
The oldest line in the business, but it's you got to have the singer and you got to have a great song. You know, anybody can play the guitar, you know, I mean, finding a voice on the guitar, you know, it's hard, but having a great singer that, you know, when you hear it on the radio, you go, you know, that's Paul McCartney, that's Dave from the Kings, you know, and I think that is very important.
Well, then on that note, let's end her off. Thanks for doing the show, man.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Mr. Zero of the Kings. Switching to Glide, this beat goes on. This song called, so many songs on that record. It's so good. It's such a great record. Pick it up on iTunes or go buy the CD. I have the CD. I have a hat. And I am stoked. Everybody, please don't forget to go to patreon.com/apolog to pledge to the show, help the show out just by pledging a monthly amount. It could be $1, it could be $5, it could be $20. If it's $20, I'll come and wash your car. Promise. Hey, also, don't forget about Amazon. Go to apolog.ca, click on the banners on the right side. Support the show. Don't forget about Insight Recorders, apolog.ca/shop. Don't forget to like the show on Facebook, subscribe and rate on iTunes, and everybody, thanks so much for listening to the show week after week after week. Next week, I have Kevin Lyman, founder of the Warped Tour. That's a good one, too. So they're just getting better, and I'm going to have a few other people that I still got to nail down, and everybody, thanks so much for making my week. Really enjoyed doing this show, and I hope you do too. So let me know with a comment on Facebook or something. Okay, buddies. See you later.